storm is rising against the privileged minority of the earth.
This is why I say it's liberty or it's death. It's freedom for everybody or freedom for nobody.
This is an NBC News Hotline special report.
We're at a turning point in the history of this nation. We need to stand for freedom. There's an escalating authoritarianism and even a creeping fascism. Freedom is precious. If we don't fight for it, you lose it.
This much is clear.
We must rebel.
This is our country. We have always lived in it. We were happy. Then you came. We have to protect ourselves. We have to save our country. We have to fight for what is ours.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. It's your brother, Amir Deese. Welcome to this Class War Battlefield podcast episode. You know, I've talked in the past about taxes. I am a big believer that the wealthy have a moral obligation to pay their taxes. And they have a moral obligation to pay a lot of taxes. And I believe this, not because I'm not wealthy, or because I want to fleece them. No, I believe this because I truthfully believe that being born wealthy or earning money in a lifetime that enables you to be wealthy means that you are blessed by the divine, and that the divine did not bless you, or the divine blessed you, should I say, with that ability to generate money, to generate wealth, to build, to construct for your society. The divine blessed you with those things, not to make you better, but to challenge you, to challenge your spirit, to challenge your soul, to see what you do with those blessings. And that the challenge of that money, of that wealth, is to see what you will do with it. Now, here's the funny thing, is I believe that all these people running around here talking about meritocratic this, meritocratic that, they believe the same thing I believe. They believe, okay, there's a blessing here that's innate in all this. But the conclusion that they draw, because of their belief in meritocracy, the conclusion that they draw is that the test was whether or not they'd make the money, not what you do with it. And even those who do believe that the test is what you do with it, they come to the conclusion that, oh, well, it's not the government's role to do anything with it. It's my role. No. No. The government is supposed to be an independent arbitrator between the wealthy and the rest of the society to enable the rest of the society to flourish off of what it does. European history paints a very destructive picture of what society really is. You've basically had two structures that have formed the backbone of European societies. And I know, people keep saying, oh, well, we're Americans, we're not Europeans. You're white. You came from Europe. I don't care if it was 5 generations ago, 2 generations ago, 10 generations ago, 15 generations ago. You came from Europe. So your cultural leanings come from Europe. This is why, for instance, the Confederacy concept, with which the Native Americans used, which was very democratic, very bottom-up democratic, was so difficult for Europeans to use because they weren't used to something like that. Their cultural leanings prescribe their society to a hierarchical end. The two forms of government that have been pervasive throughout Europe for its entire history are kingdoms, where one person rules autocratically, or republics, where a group of wealthy people rule collectively, but the society is still pretty much at their whims. Even presently in Europe, while things on a social democratic standpoint are definitely a little bit better than the United States, that is still how their society is organized. They literally have those two forms of government intertwined, where the oligarchic elite still exercises an enormous amount of power in their countries, but because they've taken serious the idea of government being somewhat independent and acting as a independent arbiter between the society and the oligarchy, you know, the life is a little bit better because government actually performs that task. America has drawn heavily from both of these concepts. And the oligarchs in this society do not see the government as needing to be separate from itself. The oligarchs, I did an episode recently on federalism versus anti-federalism. While that is still true and that holds true, part of the calculation that is really impacting the society right now and has been since the formation of this country is whether or not the oligarchs should own the government. Everybody running around here talking about the founding fathers fails to see the fact that the founding fathers, almost to a man, were wealthy people. They saw themselves as forming a government more beneficial for themselves than for the society. They couched it in language of, oh, it's going to be great for the entire society. Okay, if that was the case, then why did they limit the enfranchisement so narrowly when they created this country that was supposed to be for the society? No, their idea was that the wealthy control the levers of power, that the wealthy control the government, that the wealthy own the government to an extent. And that's what we keep banging into, is this idea that the government should be subjugated completely and wholly, not to the people, but to the wealthy and the people who are the business minded, as they say. Now, when you start seeing this reality in real time, and you start rolling your mind over what this means for the country, it bothers you a little bit. I mean, the first time when I realized it, it bothered me, because then the word oligarchy took on new meaning. But once you start digesting where we're at in history, where we've come from, you realize it is true. Now, when it comes to taxes, because the idea that wealth is a blessing, and I'm completely blanking, there was a rich man who actually wrote a book on this back in, I think it was the turn of the 1900s, the 20th century. So, but I can't think of what the title was, and I think it was Carlyle who wrote it, if I'm not mistaken. But because of this idea that money is a blessing, is in the mind, I do believe it was Carlyle who wrote that book. The Gospel of Wealth is the name of it, if I remember correctly. Anyway, this obscene amount of wealth, because of the idea that wealth is a blessing, is somewhere in their minds. They have to justify their actions, to justify that they're being beneficial to the society. And you see this in the arguments that they put forward. But when the wealth begins to get obscene, as it did in the early 1900s, the reasonings behind the inequalities in the society begins to get really flamboyantly outrageous, and nobody can take them seriously or believe them anymore. And so they have to make a decision. And historically, I mean, this goes all the way back to the Roman Empire and the Roman Republic, they tend to make wrong decisions because egotism. This is, again, something we have to remember. Now, I think when it comes to taxes, and the idea of wealth being a blessing, how the wealthy actually sidestep paying their taxes while claiming that they're still being just in resolving the problems of the society is through philanthropy. The book Philanthrocapitalism, which is a meandering book, but it still gives you an underlining, highlighted, should I say, idea of where these people's minds are at when it comes to sculpting the world with their wealth. Philanthropy allows them to go to bed at night and to believe that they're still doing good while depriving the government of the money that it needs to actually protect the commonwealth. Now, earlier I talked about the two forms of government that Europe that Europe had. Now, the idea behind the oligarch was to essentially make the court equal within the kingdom. And through making the court equal and through allowing discussion of the primary problems of the day, there was a belief that even with bad leadership, a society would be more likely to flourish and prosper and move forward rather than become stagnant and decay. The problem was when you combined the group mentality with a competitive mentality, that would necessitate that anybody with a caring, softer, empathetic demeanor, a compassionate demeanor, whenever they got into positions of power, the rest of the group would be so competitively aimed against one another that they would drum those people out. So then the only minds thinking on subjects that affected the entire society would be people who were steeped in competitive rhetoric. And so we actually seen this with Ben and Jerry's. We've seen this all with a bunch of other companies, too. But this is why we are where we're at right now, is because the people with the mentality to actually care for the society have been drummed out of the public life. So I'm trying to think how how I want to really get this across to you guys, but this idea, of taxes is seen as getting in the way of the natural proclivity of the wealthy to do God's work. That's what it's seen as. And they believe it. They believe that they can use their philanthropy to do more good than the government can, which, by the way, has not been proven true yet. They believe they can use their philanthropic mind state to build a better society with a better government than the government that already exists. But here's the interesting part. Here's the interesting part, and I was thinking about this the other day when I was listening to something on why taxes are bad. What these people are basically doing, is they're doing the thing that they say they are against the government doing. They're picking winners and losers through their philanthropy. Uh-huh. You didn't realize that, did you? These people who pay people to tell you that the government picking winners and losers is bad are literally picking winners and losers. They're literally picking winners and losers. That's what they're doing. When you have a person who can go out and spend $1 million a year, and if they were to live 50 years, they still wouldn't spend all of the money that they have. But they could go out and they could spend $1 billion. So they start putting, $2 million into this organization, $2 million into that organization. Do you really think they're walking up and saying, whatever you're doing, here's the money? No. Most of these people are not doing that. Most of these people are walking up to companies, or excuse me, to organizations, and saying, if you'll do what I want you to do, I'll give you the money. I don't want to use their name, because some people may not even know that this happened, and they may still be part of the organization. One of the early high-profile shooting cases in the country of a young black male. There was an organization that had put together statistics. They had put together a report that they themselves had, through regional connections, regional money, they had put this report together on police interactions with the black community. A report which I first heard about on what was then a very small group of black podcasters. The report was stunning, and it was good. It had some really powerful information that could be proved, that could be fact-checked. It was all there. On black Twitter, this report gained a lot of traction. A lot of traction. And when the news finally started talking about the death of this person who had been killed, at first, the coverage was lackluster. They didn't have a lot of details, and they kept saying that. And I'm like, there's this report there, guys. When are you guys going to find it? Now, I didn't let anybody know. I just let it play out. And soon they did come across this report. A report which they openly admitted for like the first couple of days that this came from this organization. Now, this organization was a radical organization. There was no bones about it. They were a very radical organization. It was a radical black organization that was very studious and scholarly. Soon, though, because, you know, the news didn't do their homework, they discovered that this was a very radical organization. So they would refer to information from the report without naming the source which they got it from because of the radical nature of the group. There was a billionaire who, now this group was, this radical group was really the first to come out and say on a local level, like, look, there's an epidemic of these police shootings, vigilante shootings. There's something that needs to be done with this. And they started gaining traction across the country. Now, I will say this had to do with Trayvon Martin. I think I can say that safely. And this group started gaining traction across the country. And it started gaining traction because of Occupy Wall Street had just been busted. And Occupy, people who were coming out of Occupy, was trying to make connections in the black community. Because that was the only community that they really hadn't, black and brown communities, they were the only community that they hadn't been able to really infiltrate with their message. So... By the way, the word infiltrator isn't bad, guys. Yeah, look it up. But, this billionaire comes along because it's very clear that there's something bubbling in the black community. And, this group, at first, you know, all of the quote-unquote black leaders went down to talk to the group, and the group told them what train to catch, gave them the fare to catch it, and kicked them out the house. Told them, we ain't listening to you. You've done nothing on this. Get out. And so there's a problem now. Because these people, and they were all young, were not listening to the old traditional groups. They sent some Congress people down there, black Congress people of fame. And those black Congress people were told the same thing. Here, you know, here's some bus fare. You catch the next train out of town. We don't want you. So now there's a problem. What do you do? You have a radical group that's gaining popularity, that's doing real hard journalistic work for the black community. What do you do? Well, this billionaire comes along and says, look, guys, you know, I love what you're doing, but here's the thing. All this radical stuff got, you know, we can get you money so you can do really good work for the black community, but we can get you money for that. But all this radical stuff got to stop. And the way that the story seems to have evolved is there is a split in the group. Because... the billionaire was like, I'll make sure you got, you know, a couple $1 million every single year to do exactly what you want. Just cut out the radical stuff. And what happened was within a year, that group watered itself down. Its radical members seemed to have left, and it took the money. Now, look, ladies and gentlemen, you may say, well, yeah, but they're still doing good for the community. I have been trying to figure out for years why, you know, conservatives, okay, let me back up. I've been trying to figure out for years, why the heck are there radicals? Conservatives will be quick to yell about, we're made by God. God wants us to be here. God wants us this. God wants us that. Yes, I believe that also. I believe that there is an order to things. not hierarchical order, but I believe that the parts in which we have identified in a society, conservative, progressive, not liberal, y'all, progressive, revolutionary, radical, all of these things are there for a purpose. And while conservatives are pretty adamant about what their job is, and part of a lot of what they say is actually correct. They are the protectors of certain norms. Certain norms. I'll have to get into that at another time, though. Progressives are supposed to be the ones pushing us forward along other lines. Revolutionaries are the ones who are supposed to be challenging us every so often to turn the wheel forward. Because progressives are notoriously moderating. They're essentially the force that drives the system forward. That's what a progressive's job is. It's like they are the system's managers that keeps distilling what the system needs in order to keep it growing and to keep it healthy. That's what a progressive seems to be. A revolutionary is that mechanism which says, okay, you know, we're growing a tree here, so at this point we need to now stop being just, oh God, I used to actually know some of this terminology. I'm kind of embarrassed that I don't anymore. You know, we have to just go from being just the stick to now having all these branches out, you know. That's the job of a revolutionary. To say, it's time that we push forward very quickly and not just in slow fashion. Where a progressive is more like, slow fashion, yes. You know, we'll get things done over the course of 10 years or 5 years or 1 year and what have you. And, you know, the hardest part about being a progressive is you need to have a plan. They are the moderating force that keeps things moving forward, while the conservatives are the ones that keeps things gelled together in a certain shape. So the problem with that, of course, is, you know, if you're trying to grow a tree, if the conservative gets out of hand, then all you'll have is a big stick, you know, rising. Rising 50 feet into the air. No, the conservatives have to be flexible enough to allow the revolutionaries to say, we need branches here, we need a trunk here, we need this here, we need that here. That's the job of a revolutionary. To clarify and define that major plan. And then the radical, the question that I always had was, what the heck is a radical for? Why is a radical there? Why is a radical there? Oh, to tear up the root or something like that. That is not just the job of a radical. In a system, and this is one issue I think that many Europeans have had a problem with, is that radicals don't have to be necessarily outside a system as long as the system is healthy. As long as the system is healthy. The radical is like the probiotic inside the body. The radical is like the microbiome portions inside the body. That's actually a better analogy. They synthesize the food and the water and all of the things that you pull into a society. They synthesize it. They get rid of the bad stuff. And they synthesize everything else and activate the cells around them to take in that information, you know, those molecules, and make energy out of it. They basically are the living life force within a society. The moment you do not have radicals is the moment you are going to approach not only stagnation, but shortly, death. The radicals are what keeps a society living. With without him, you don't have a healthy society. And the problem with a lot of these business people is they see radicals as the enemy. So they seek to get rid of all radicals, all radical thought, all radical action, all radical anything. You need that radicalism. And you need that radicalism, to some extent, to believe that it's outside of the system. Because, and this is something that I've learned recently, when it comes to your microbiome is part of your body, but it is also separate from your body. There has to be a little bit of independence with those organisms so that they can attend to all of the cells and all of the needs of the tissues which they are interacting with. Yes. Yeah, I know. That's a little deep, but hopefully it doesn't drive you that crazy. Taxes. Because I know all this started with taxes. So let me get back there because, wow. I didn't expect to cover that. Actually, I'll get to taxes. I'll get back to taxes in a moment. I do want to say, though, if we were to really look at a society like a human body, we would not in any way want competitiveness or individuality to govern that society. Because in the body, if you have cells at odds with one another, your body breaks down. Or your body initiates a protocol to kill those cells. Or your body initiates a protocol within those cells to have them destroy themselves. And if you have a cell that's acting independently, or if you have multiple cells that are acting independently, they tend to become either cancerous or, again, initiate a self-destruction. These things are not healthy for a body. They're not. So to have a society act the same way, not good. Anyway, on the front of taxes, let me return to that. In the idea of, you know, when you look at the whole philanthropic concept, the idea behind philanthropy is to buy influence, is to buy public favor. Now, in addition to that, it is to try and sculpt society in a way that reminds people of your vision for the society. The problem is, most often, the vision is not only terribly limited, but it's not impactful on a societal level. It's only impactful on the groups which these wealthy people frequent the most. I often think about during the Roman time period, the wealthy would throw these elaborate balls and parties that the city of Rome would participate in, and it was great, and it was fine, and it was wonderful. And then after it was done, the majority of the people were still poor and went back to their meager existence and were left to basically fend for themselves. And yet, wealthy person after wealthy person, instead of caring for the commonwealth, kept doing this. Instead of caring for the commonwealth, they kept purchasing good vibes, good feelings, while they were at the same time destroying the lives of the same people that they were trying to show that they weren't monstrous. We have the same problem today. Moreover, there's an interesting connection between what's happening today and the New Deal. And this is something that I've thought about a lot, too. Years ago, I read a couple of really good and interesting books on what's often called the Progressive Period, the early 1900s. And what I found most startling about those books, about the descriptions, wasn't what was going on during the Progressive Period, but what led to it. And when I started reading about FDR and Arthur Schlesinger's piece on FDR, his, I think it's four books that he wrote on him, I made some connections between the Progressive Era and the New Deal, or the coming of the New Deal, which I will share with you right now. In the early 1900s, in order to help progress the society forward, because people were really, really pissed off at the wealthy because things had gotten so obscene when it came to wealth, the wealth disparity was just, it was torturously bad. So they started petitioning the government to do something about those wealthy people who wanted to treat their employees bad and yet force them to make a ton of money just so these people could walk around and say, look, I have money. And the government started acting. Well, to kind of counter that, wealthy people started putting money into philanthropy. That's what they started doing. Now, this was the early 1900s. You fast forward to the beginning of the 1930s, which was almost 30 years later. Wealthy people had been performing philanthropy en masse for three decades. Using the logic that wealthy people today use, which is, it's my money, I know how best to use it, blah, blah, blah. You would have thought that there was nothing that needed to be done in society. After all, these people had essentially put billions of dollars into projects that would make the society better. Obviously, you know the history of the New Deal, so you know I'm lying when I say that. Okay? They had put billions of dollars into philanthropy, and yet the society was still crumbling. And yet the society was still crumbling. There was so much to still do that Franklin Delano Roosevelt, even if World War II had not happened, Franklin Delano Roosevelt would have had things to still do to build the society up better in the 2040s, and probably, if he had lived, up until the 2050s, if he wanted to make the society better. That is how little actual impact philanthropy has, and it had then. And this is just something that we don't talk about. This is something that we do not talk about. Philanthropy is not, sorry about that, philanthropy is not the answer to social problems. It's not. Because one, it really is all about what the wealthy wants. They're buying influence, basically. And two, they don't have a commitment to commonwealth. They have a commitment to competition, which is negative for the society. I just want to make my stance on taxes very clear. If you're making $20 or $30 million in a year, you need to be paying more taxes. On the top, 20 million, you really should be paying at least 60%. I'll settle for 50. I'll settle for 50% tax rate on that. If you're making over $100 million, you need to be paying 70 to 80% of that. I'll settle for 60 on that one, or 65. And if you're making over $1 billion on the top rate, this I'm talking about over $100 million now, no less than 75. No less than 75. Maybe even 90. We'll put some loopholes in there for, you know, if you're paying employees or redecorating your office or paving roads around your office. We're doing 90. We're doing 90. And those loopholes are going to be very small. So, yeah, I am a big believer that you got to pay your fair share on that. Even, by the way, I'm a big believer that even if you're giving it away, and you're a billionaire, you have to still pay some of that in. And I'm not talking 20 or 30% here. I'm talking about, you know, 70 or 80 still. You're not going to buy influence while you're fleecing the company, the country. You're going to have to actually pay your fair share. And by the way, that's another thing that I want to stress here. That idea of fair share. Oftentimes, the wealthy will say, oh, well, if you're on welfare, you're not paying your fair share. If you're poor, you're not paying your fair share. Oh, well, maybe the people who don't have skin in the game, well, maybe they need to have some skin in the game. They need to pay their fair share. Well, if you would pay them, you know, the $20, $30 an hour that they deserve, these people would have a lot of skin in the game. But because of your greed, you won't. And by the way, let's talk about the fact that they're producing $150 per hour of value for you, and you're paying them $11 or $10 or in some cases $9 or $8. Now it's getting to the point where they have to pay more. But let's talk about that. What are you doing with the other $100? And why are you only paying $20 of that $100 in taxes? Because you sure enough ain't earned it. Somebody produced it for you. So let's talk about your fair share. Yeah, I think we'll let you keep $5 out of that, okay? Now, how you feel about that? Oh, and if you want to give your employee some more of that money, now we're going to take a little bit off of that tax break for you. And so now you can, you know, if you want to give your employee the $25 an hour that they deserve, okay, fine. That's great. Now we're going to let you keep $10 out of it because you're doing what's right. Oh, yeah. And if you keep that money year-round at a local bank, we're going to let you keep another five, maybe another $10 on that if you keep it in a local bank and you don't take it out of that local bank. These are real tax plans that can work, y'all. Sorry that this one was so, as I said earlier, meandering. If you have any questions, comments, concerns, you know, let me know. I'm your brother, Brian Maradis. I'll see you on the next one. Peace. There's a shadow on the faces of the men who sent the guns to the wars that are fought in places where their business interest runs. On the radio, talk shows, and the TV, you hear one thing again and again: how the USA stands for freedom, and we come to the aid of a friend. But who are the ones that we call our friends? These governments killing their own, or the people who find they can't take anymore, and they pick up a gun.